Book 4. War, Early Victories, and the Turning Point. Chapter 18. The Fall of Poland. At 10 o'clock on the morning of September 5, 1939, General Halder had a talk with General von Brauchitsch, the commander-in-chief of the German army, and General von Bock, who led Army Group North. After sizing up the situation as it looked to them at the beginning of the fifth day of the German attack on Poland, they agreed, as Halder wrote in his diary, that the enemy is practically beaten. By the evening of the previous day, the battle for the corridor had ended with the junction of General von Kluge's 4th Army pushing eastward from Pomerania and General von Kückler's 3rd Army driving westward from East Prussia. It was in this battle that General Heinz Guderian first made a name for himself with his tanks. At one point, racing east across the corridor, they had been counterattacked by the Pomorska Brigade of Cavalry, and this writer, coming upon the scene a few days later, saw the sickening evidence of the carnage. It was symbolic of the brief Polish campaign. Horses against tanks, the cavalryman's long lance against the tank's long cannon. Brave and valiant and foolhardy though they were, the Poles were simply overwhelmed by the German onslaught. This was their, and the world's, first experience of the Blitzkrieg. The sudden surprise attack, the fighter planes and bombers roaring overhead, reconnoitering, attacking, spreading flame and terror, the Stukas screaming as they dove, the tanks, whole divisions of them, breaking through and thrusting forward 30 or 40 miles in a day, self-propelled, rapid-firing heavy guns rolling 40 miles an hour down even the rutty Polish roads. The incredible speed of even the infantry, of the whole vast army of 1.5 million men on motorized wheels, directed and coordinated through a maze of electronic communications consisting of intricate radio, telephone, and telegraphic networks. This was a monstrous mechanized juggernaut such as the earth had never seen. Within 48 hours, the Polish Air Force was destroyed, most of its 500 first-line planes having been blown up by German bombing on their home airfields before they could take off. Installations were burned and most of the ground crews were killed or wounded. Krakow, the second city of Poland, fell on September 6th. That night, the Polish government fled from Warsaw to Lublin. The next day, Halder busied himself with plans to begin transferring troops to the Western Front, though he could detect no activity there. On the afternoon of September 8th, the 4th Panzer Division reached the outskirts of the Polish capital, while directly south of the city, rolling up from Silesia and Slovakia, Reichenau's 10th Army captured Kielce, and List's 14th Army arrived at Sandomierz, at the junction of the Vistula and San rivers. In 1 week, the Polish army had been vanquished. Most of its 35 divisions, all that there had been time to mobilize, had been either shattered or caught in a vast pincers movement that closed in around Warsaw. There now remained for the Germans the second phase, tightening the noose around the dazed and disorganized Polish units which were surrounded and destroying them, and completing a second and larger pincers movement 100 miles to the east, which would trap the remaining Polish formations west of Brest-Litovsk and the River Bug. This phase began September 9th and ended on September 17th. The left wing of Bock's Army Group North, headed for Brest-Litovsk, which Guderian's 19th Corps reached on the 14th and captured 2 days later. On September 17th, it met patrols of List's 14th Army, 50 miles south of Brest-Litovsk, at Lodowa, closing the second great pincers there. The counterattack, as Guderian later observed, had come to a definite conclusion on September 17th. All Polish forces, except for a handful on the Russian border, were surrounded. Pockets of Polish troops in the Warsaw Triangle and farther west near Posen held out valiantly, but they were doomed. The Polish government, or what was left of it after being unceasingly bombed and strafed by the Luftwaffe, reached a village on the Romanian frontier on the 15th. For it and the proud nation, all was over, except the dying in the ranks of the units which still, with incredible fortitude, held out. It was now time for the Russians to move in on the stricken country to grab a share of the spoils. The Russians invade Poland. The Kremlin in Moscow, like every other seat of government, had been taken by surprise at the rapidity with which the German armies hurtled through Poland. On September 5th, Molotov, in giving a formal written reply to the Nazis' suggestion that Russia attack Poland from the east, stated that this would be done at a suitable time, but that this time has not yet come. He thought that excessive haste might injure the Soviet cause, but he insisted that even though the Germans got there first, they must scrupulously observe the line of demarcation in Poland agreed upon in the secret clauses of the Nazi-Soviet pact. Russian suspicion of the Germans was already evident. So was the feeling in the Kremlin that the German conquest of Poland might take quite a long time. But shortly after midnight of September 8th, after a German armored division had reached the outskirts of Warsaw, Ribbentrop wired urgent a top-secret message to Schulenburg in Moscow, stating that operations in Poland were progressing even beyond our expectations, and that in these circumstances Germany would like to know the military intentions of the Soviet government. By 4:10 p.m. the next day, Molotov had replied that Russia would move militarily within the next few days. Earlier in the day, the Soviet Foreign Commissar had officially congratulated the Germans on the entry of German troops into Warsaw. On September 10th, Molotov and Ambassador von der Schulenburg got into a fine snafu. After declaring that the Soviet government had been taken completely by surprise by the unexpectedly rapid German military successes, and that the Soviet Union was consequently in a difficult situation, the Foreign Commissar touched on the excuse which the Kremlin would have to give for its own aggression in Poland. This was, as Schulenburg wired Berlin, most urgent and top secret. That Poland was falling apart, and that it was necessary for the Soviet Union, in consequence, to come to the aid of the Ukrainians and the White Russians threatened by Germany. This argument, said Molotov, was necessary to make the intervention of the Soviet Union plausible to the masses, and at the same time avoid giving the Soviet Union the appearance of an aggressor. Furthermore, Molotov complained that General von Brauchitsch had just been quoted by DNB as saying that military action was no longer necessary on the German eastern border. If that were so, if the war was over, Russia, said Molotov, could not start a new war. He was very displeased about the whole situation. To further complicate matters, he summoned Schulenburg to the Kremlin on September 14th, and after informing him that the Red Army would march sooner than they had anticipated, demanded to know when Warsaw would fall. In order to justify their move, the Russians must wait on the capture of the Polish capital. The Commissar had raised some embarrassing questions. When would Warsaw fall? How did the Germans like being blamed for Russian intervention? On the evening of September 15th, Ribbentrop dispatched a most urgent, a top-secret message to Molotov through the German ambassador, answering them. Warsaw, he said, would be occupied in the next few days. Germany would welcome the Soviet military operation now. As to the Russian excuse blaming Germany for it, this was out of the question, contrary to the true German intentions, would be in contradiction to the arrangements made in Moscow, and finally would make the two states appear as enemies before the whole world. He ended by asking the Soviet government to set the day and the hour for their attack on Poland. This was done the next evening, and two dispatches of Schulenburg, which are among the captured German papers, telling how it was done, give a revealing picture of the Kremlin's deceit. I saw Molotov at 6 p.m., Schulenburg wired on September 16th. Molotov declared that military intervention by the Soviet Union was imminent, perhaps even tomorrow or the day after. Stalin was at present in consultation with the military leaders. Molotov added that the Soviet government intended to justify its procedure as follows. The Polish state had disintegrated and no longer existed. Therefore, all agreements concluded with Poland were void. Third powers might try to profit by the chaos which had arisen. The Soviet government considered itself obligated to intervene to protect its Ukrainian and White Russian brothers and make it possible for these unfortunate people to work in peace. Since Germany could be the only possible third power in question, Schulenburg objected. Molotov conceded that the proposed argument of the Soviet government contained a note that was jarring to German sensibilities, but asked us, in view of the difficult situation of the Soviet government, not to stumble over this piece of straw. The Soviet government unfortunately saw no possibility of any other motivation, since the Soviet Union had heretofore not bothered about the plight of its minorities in Poland, and had to justify abroad, in some way or other, its present intervention. At 5:20 p.m. on September 17th, Schulenburg got off another most urgent and top-secret wire to Berlin. Stalin received me at 2 o'clock and declared that the Red Army would cross the Soviet border at 6 o'clock. Soviet planes would begin today to bomb the district east of Lvov, Lemberg. When Schulenburg objected to 3 points in the Soviet communiqué, the Russian dictator, with the utmost readiness, altered the text. Thus it was that on the shabby pretext that because Poland had ceased to exist and therefore the Polish-Soviet non-aggression pact had also ceased to exist, and because it was necessary to protect its own interests and those of the Ukrainian and White Russian minorities, the Soviet Union trampled over a prostrate Poland beginning on the morning of September 17th. To add insult to injury, the Polish ambassador in Moscow was informed that Russia would maintain strict neutrality in the Polish conflict. The next day, September 18th, Soviet troops met the Germans at Brest-Litovsk, where exactly 21 years before a newborn Bolshevik government had gone back on its country's ties with the Western Allies and had received from the German army and accepted separate peace terms of great harshness. And yet, though they were now accomplices of Nazi Germany in wiping ancient Poland off the map, the Russians were at once distrustful of their new comrades. At his meeting with the German ambassador on the eve of the Soviet aggression, Stalin had expressed his doubts, as Schulenburg duly notified Berlin, whether the German high command would stand by the Moscow agreements and withdraw to the line that had been agreed upon. The ambassador tried to reassure him, but apparently with no great success. In view of Stalin's well-known attitude of mistrust, Schulenburg wired Berlin, I would be gratified if I were authorized to make a further declaration of such a nature as to remove his last doubts. The next day, September 19th, Ribbentrop telegraphed the ambassador, authorizing him to tell Stalin that the agreements which I made at Moscow will, of course, be kept, and that they are regarded by us as the foundation stone of the new friendly relations between Germany and the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, friction between the two unnatural partners continued. On September 17th, there was disagreement over the text of a joint communiqué which would justify the Russo-German destruction of Poland. Stalin objected to the German version because it presented the facts all too frankly. Whereupon he wrote out his own version, a masterpiece of subterfuge, and forced the Germans to accept it. It stated that the joint aim of Germany and Russia was to restore peace and order in Poland, which has been destroyed by the disintegration of the Polish state, and to help the Polish people to establish new conditions for its political life. For cynicism, Hitler had met his match in Stalin. At first, both dictators seemed to have considered setting up a rump Polish state on the order of Napoleon's Grand Duchy of Warsaw in order to mollify world public opinion. But on September 19th, Molotov disclosed that the Bolsheviks were having second thoughts on that. After angrily protesting to Schulenburg that the German generals were disregarding the Moscow agreement by trying to grab territory that should go to Russia, he came to the main point. Molotov hinted, Schulenburg wired Berlin, that the original inclination entertained by the Soviet government and Stalin personally to permit the existence of a residual Poland had given way to the inclination to partition Poland along the Pisa-Narew-Wistula-San line. The Soviet government wishes to commence negotiations on this matter at once. Thus, the initiative to partition Poland completely, to deny the Polish people any independent existence of their own whatsoever, came from the Russians. But the Germans did not need much urging to agree. On September 23rd, Ribbentrop wired Schulenburg, instructing him to tell Molotov that the Russian idea of a borderline along the well-known Four Rivers line coincides with the view of the Reich government. He proposed to again fly to Moscow to work out the details of that, as well as of the definitive structure of the Polish area. Stalin now took personal charge of the negotiations, and his German allies learned, as his British and American allies later would also learn, what a tough, cynical, and opportunistic bargainer he was. The Soviet dictator summoned Schulenburg to the Kremlin at 8 p.m. on September 25th, and the ambassador's dispatch later that evening warned Berlin of some stern realities and of some chickens that were coming home to roost. Stalin stated he considered it wrong to leave an independent residual Poland. He proposed that from the territory to the east of the demarcation line, all the province of Warsaw, which extends to the Bug, should be added to our share. In return, we should waive our claim to Lithuania. Stalin added that if we consented, the Soviet Union would immediately take up the solution of the problem of the Baltic countries in accordance with the secret protocol of August 23rd, and expected in this matter the unstinting support of the German government. Stalin expressly indicated Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, but did not mention Finland. This was a shrewd and hard bargain. Stalin was offering to trade two Polish provinces, which the Germans had already captured, for the Baltic states. He was taking advantage of the great service he had rendered Hitler, making it possible for him to attack Poland, to get everything he could for Russia while the getting was good. Moreover, he was proposing that the Germans take over the mass of the Polish people. As a Russian, he well knew what centuries of history had taught, that the Poles would never peacefully submit to the loss of their independence. Let them be a headache for the Germans, not the Russians. In the meantime, he would get the Baltic states, which had been taken from Russia after the First World War, and whose geographical position offered the Soviet Union great protection against surprise attack by his German ally. Ribbentrop arrived by plane in Moscow for the second time at 6 p.m. on September 28th, and before proceeding to the Kremlin, he had time to read two telegrams from Berlin which apprised him of what the Russians were up to. They were messages forwarded from the German minister at Tallinn, who reported that the Estonian government had just informed him that the Soviet Union had demanded, under the gravest threat of imminent attack, military and air bases in Estonia. Later that night, after a long conference with Stalin and Molotov, Ribbentrop wired Hitler that this very night a pact was being concluded which would put two Red Army divisions and an Air Force brigade on Estonian territory without, however, abolishing the Estonian system of government at this time. But the Führer, an experienced hand at this sort of thing, knew how fleeting Estonia's time would be. The very next day, Ribbentrop was informed that Hitler had ordered the evacuation of the 86,000 Volksdeutsche in Estonia and Latvia. Stalin was presenting his bill, and Hitler, for the time being at least, had to pay it. He was instantly abandoning not only Estonia but Latvia, both of which, he had agreed in the Nazi-Soviet pact, belonged in the Soviet sphere of interest. Before the day was up, he was also giving up Lithuania, on Germany's northeastern border, which, according to the secret clauses of the Moscow Pact, belonged in the Reich's sphere. Stalin had presented the Germans two choices in the meeting with Ribbentrop, which began at 10 p.m. on September 27th, and lasted until 1 a.m. They were, as he had suggested to Schulenburg on the 25th, acceptance of the original line of demarcation in Poland along the Pisa, Narew, Vistula, and San rivers, with Germany getting Lithuania, or yielding Lithuania to Russia in return for more Polish territory, the province of Lublin and the lands to the east of Warsaw, which would give the Germans almost all of the Polish people. Stalin strongly urged the second choice, and Ribbentrop, in a long telegram to Hitler filed at 4 a.m. on September 28th, put it up to Hitler, who agreed. Dividing up Eastern Europe took quite a bit of intricate drawing of maps, and after 3.5 more hours of negotiations on the afternoon of September 28th, followed by a state banquet at the Kremlin, Stalin and Molotov excused themselves in order to confer with a Latvian delegation they had summoned to Moscow. Ribbentrop dashed off to the Opera House to take in an act of Swan Lake, returning to the Kremlin at midnight for further consultations about maps and other things. At 5 a.m., Molotov and Ribbentrop put their signatures to a new pact officially called the German-Soviet Boundary and Friendship Treaty, while Stalin once more beamed on, as a German official later reported, with obvious satisfaction. He had reason to. This official, Andor Henke, understate secretary in the Foreign Office, who had served for many years in the embassy at Moscow, wrote a detailed and amusing account of the talks. It was the only German record made of the second day's conferences. The treaty itself, which was made public, announced the boundary of the respective national interests of the two countries in the former Polish state, and stated that within their acquired territories they would re-establish peace and order, and assure the people living there a peaceful life in keeping with their national character. But, as with the previous Nazi-Soviet deal, there were secret protocols, three of them, of which two contained the meat of the agreement. One added Lithuania to the Soviet sphere of influence, and the provinces of Lublin and eastern Warsaw to the German. The second was short and to the point. Both parties will tolerate in their territories no Polish agitation which affects the territories of the other party. They will suppress in their territories all beginnings of such agitation, and inform each other concerning suitable measures for this purpose. So Poland, like Austria and Czechoslovakia before it, disappeared from the map of Europe. But this time Adolf Hitler was aided and abetted in his obliteration of a country by the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which had posed for so long as the champion of the oppressed peoples. This was the fourth partition of Poland by Germany and Russia. Arnold Toynbee, in his various writings, calls it the fifth partition. Austria had participated in the others. And while it lasted, it was to be by far the most ruthless and pitiless. In the secret protocol of September 28th, though signed at 5 a.m. September 29th, the treaty is officially dated September 28th, Hitler and Stalin agreed to institute in Poland a regime of terror designed to brutally suppress Polish freedom, culture, and national life. Hitler fought and won the war in Poland, but the greater winner was Stalin, whose troops scarcely fired a shot. German casualties in Poland were officially given as 10,572 killed, 30,322 wounded, and 3,400 missing. The Soviet Union got nearly half of Poland and a stranglehold on the Baltic states. It blocked Germany more solidly than ever from two of its main long-term objectives, Ukrainian wheat and Romanian oil, both badly needed if Germany was to survive the British blockade. Even Poland's oil region of Borislav Dragobich, which Hitler desired, was claimed successfully by Stalin, who graciously agreed to sell the Germans the equivalent of the area's annual production. Why did Hitler pay such a high price to the Russians? It is true that he had agreed to it in August in order to keep the Soviet Union out of the Allied camp and out of the war. But he had never been a stickler for keeping agreements, and now, with Poland conquered by an incomparable feat of German arms, he might have been expected to welch, as the army urged, on the August 23rd pact. If Stalin objected, the Führer could threaten him with attack by the most powerful army in the world, as the Polish campaign had just proved it to be. Or could he? Not while the British and French stood at arms in the West. To deal with Britain and France, he must keep his rear free. This, as subsequent utterances of his would make clear, was the reason why he allowed Stalin to strike such a hard bargain. But he did not forget the Soviet dictator's harsh dealings, as he now turned his attention to the Western Front.